Furloughed Montana National Guardsmen return to work today. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us about the only underground miners still working in the city limits of Butte. And in our feature interview, News Director Sally Mock talks with government whistleblower Thomas Tam about warrantless eavesdropping on American citizens. About 600 Montana National Guardsmen and nearly as many civilians that work at Malmstrom Air Force Base were returning to work today. The move comes after Defense Secretary Chuck Hagel ordered nearly all 350,000 furloughed Defense Department civilian employees back on the job. Hagel says he based his weekend decision on a Pentagon interpretation of a law called the Pay Our Military Act, which was passed shortly before the partial government shutdown began. The Great Falls Tribune reports the Malmstrom Commissary will return to normal operating hours beginning tomorrow, and most other base services will return to normal. However, a nuclear safety and security reinspection that was scheduled for this week at Malmstrom is still postponed due to the shutdown because there's no funding for government travel. And in other news from around the state, a head-on crash west of Bozeman Sunday last night killed both drivers. The Montana Highway Patrol says a 54-year-old man from West Yellowstone was westbound on Norris Road at 10:47 p.m. when he failed to negotiate a slight curve in the roadway. His Mercedes crossed the center line and collided head-on with a Subaru driven by a 24-year-old Big Sky woman. Both drivers died at the scene. The Gallatin County Coroner's Office said the victims were William Oldroyd and Jada Krusniak. The Supreme Court won't get involved in a Montana decision to force a Hutterite religious colony to pay worker compensation insurance for jobs outside the commune. The High Court today refused to hear an appeal from the Big Sky Colony of Hutterites, which is fighting a 2009 state law requiring religious organizations to carry workers' compensation insurance. The Hutterites say the law targeted their religion and infringed on their beliefs. Its members have no personal property and make no wages as part of their communal life, and a member can't make a claim against the colony or take money for himself without risking excommunication. The Montana Supreme Court ruled that the workers' compensation requirement does not interfere with the Hutterites' religious practices, but only regulates their commercial activities. About 22,000 men worked at the underground mines of Butte at the city's peak. 22,000 men hauling 20,000 tons of ore back to the surface every day. But that was almost 100 years ago. Today, Montana Tech students are the only underground miners working in town. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us more about the training lab down in Butte's old tunnels.
It's definitely louder than the average college lab course. And rather than crisp, white lab coats, students wear mud-soaked work boots, dust-streaked faces, and hard hats.
It's actual hands-on. I'm doing real mining engineering right now, real mining work.
Montana Tech Mining Engineering Senior David Lawson is working under the light of his headlamp in an otherwise black tunnel 100 feet below ground level. He's taking turns with the other lab students lifting a heavy pneumatic jackleg drill, using different length bits to bore 2 feet, 4 feet, 6 feet into a solid rock wall at the end of a short side tunnel. Lawson is drilling into a network of shafts where miners have been digging since the late 1800s. The Orphan Boy Mine. The Anaconda Company used to mine silver, lead, and zinc out of here until it closed in the 1950s. And one of the advantages of a town like Butte, a town with a lot of old mine shafts, is Tech students don't have to go very far to get underground. The Orphan Boy is literally on campus.
From my office, it's a 10-minute walk.
Peter Knutson is the dean of the School of Mines and Engineering at Tech. He says when he went to school here decades ago, any engineering student could take on shifts at the mines still operating in Butte.
But that opportunity stopped in 1975.
Then, for almost 30 years, mining students got their practical training in mines near Phillipsburg or Columbus, hours away. Tech worked with the World Museum of Mining to reopen these shafts and start this training center in 2004, and it's been expanding ever since. The area where the students are training now was opened in 2011 after a land grant from petroleum company Arco, which used to own some of the mines in town. Junior Crystal Martin just got down here from her last class.
Yeah, I was just in calculus.
The drillers punched about a dozen six-foot holes into the rock walls at the end of two side tunnels.
Do you work your way straight up and then over and then straight down?
No.
Now, Martin is using an air compressor hose to shoot tiny white pellets into the holes.
Ammonium nitrate.
The stuff is flying everywhere. It looks like laundry detergent, but it's a lot more explosive. She pushes detonation charges about the size of Sharpie markers to the back of each hole, ahead of the white pellets. Fluorescent yellow cables run from each charge, out of the drill holes. The cables connect to each other in a spider web hanging from the wall.
Hear the bang, and then the bam of the det cord going off.
Tech hired local mining engineer Larry Hoffman to help teach the class. He's telling everyone what to expect from the explosion.
It's gonna go flop, 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 flop. And there'll be 7 seconds before the first one goes off.
The students are around a corner of the shaft, a couple hundred feet from the side tunnels. Junior Crystal Martin is prepping to witness her first underground blast.
Okay, everybody ready?
Yep.
You hear the first pop, and you kind of almost think that's it, and then the second one goes off.
Those are the timing elements going off.
And then the vibrations that come through the tunnel right at you is just incredible how powerful that blast actually is.
Martin and the rest of the class finished the long, winding path out of the shafts. Like most of the students, she doesn't really see herself ending up a mining laborer. As an engineer, though, she appreciates getting her hands dirty.
A lot of engineer to worker is misunderstanding, and actually having the opportunity to come down and do this, you get a little more understanding and respect for the people who do have to do it.
Students squint in the sun and head back to campus. Next lab, they'll be pulling up ore from the 12 feet of new tunnel they just blasted. I'm Dan Boyce, reporting in Butte.
The dispute over who will be the next leader of the Chippewa Cree tribe is ratcheting up. Ken Blatt St. Marks won a special election on July 30th to take back the chairmanship the tribal council removed him from in March. Interim chairman Richard Morissette, who came in second in the election, says the council will remove St. Marks again if he is reinstated. Morissette said in a statement he is, quote, deeply afraid for the safety and welfare of our people, end quote, if St. Marks is sworn into office. St. Marks said today the voters want him in office and the council is afraid of his oversight. The election results have been tied up in court because of a complaint that some people were allowed to vote without an identification card. The 2013 wildfire season is now behind us, but fire officials urge Montanans to actively prepare for next summer. Cindy Super is Department of Natural Resources and Conservation's Southwest Land Office Fire Prevention Coordinator. Super says over 11,000 acres burned in the agency's Missoula Protection Units this summer. A lot of those fires were sparked by lightning and resulted in evacuations. With the onset of autumn and a long winter ahead of us, the next fire season seems a long time off, but Super says this is the perfect time to take stock of potential fire risks and emergency options.
It's very basic. I understand that it's difficult to do. There are resources to help people everywhere from, you know, a single home with one or two trees or barely any acreage should be paying attention to what they would do in case they're evacuated. And if people have 10 acres or 50 acres or 100 acres, there's programs in place to help with fuels reduction and even just people who can come out and advise you on some options and alternatives that you can, how you can make your forest more healthy, not just for wildland fire, but things like mountain pine beetle or wind damage, all sorts of different things that can damage your timberlands.
We'll have more with the DNRC's Cindy Super tomorrow on Montana Evening Edition. Thomas Tam's career as an attorney with the Department of Justice's Office of Intelligence Policy and Review came to an end during the Bush administration after Tam leaked information to the New York Times that the National Security Agency was eavesdropping on American citizens without seeking a warrant. The Times story won a Pulitzer Prize. Tam's anonymous revelation to the Times became public when he described what he believes to be illegal and unconstitutional surveillance of American citizens to Newsweek magazine. Tam's whistleblowing was investigated by the government, but they eventually dropped the investigation and never charged him with anything. Meanwhile, Tam lost his job and went into debt because of his legal expenses. Tam was in Missoula recently to speak about his case to University of Montana law students. Tam's family has close ties to Montana and the law school. His uncle Edward was born in Butte and became a respected federal judge. The Jones-Tam Lecture Series at UM is named after him. In this feature interview, Thomas Tam talks with News Director Sally Mock about why he decided to leak the information about the warrantless surveillance to the press. He says it's something he thought about for a long time.
I ended up believing that we were actually breaking the law. I thought of myself, I was working
by you mean the Department of Justice.
Right, and right, the government essentially, that the Department of Justice was breaking the law, the law that concerned what we did or was what we were supposed to be doing, said that if you were going to conduct electronic surveillance, you had to get a warrant through the court that had been appointed for that process. And I figured out that there was a separate track of cases that did not go through the normal process. And I asked people in the office, and a supervisor told me that she didn't want to know. She just assumed that what we were doing was illegal. And that just really ate away at me. And I made some further inquiries and ended up feeling that we were violating the FISA statute, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act.
And the violation turned out to be that the government was tracking emails and phone calls of American citizens who were communicating overseas.
That's correct, yes. And as I said, the statute said, I mean, that's what we did legally. We applied to the court and got warrants to do that.
The FISA court.
The FISA
Foreign
court. But it turns out that
Surveillance Court.
They were doing that surveillance before presenting the cases to the FISA court, and I thought that that was a clear violation of the statute.
And a violation of executive authority.
Yes.
You leaked this information to the New York Times, and one question that has been raised about your action is why you didn't, quote, follow proper whistleblowing channels.
Well, that's, you know, I could go on for a while about that. That's a very interesting question. I'm not sure I considered myself a whistleblower. I thought more that I was a law enforcement officer. But from my view, there were only two people in the Department of Justice that knew what we were doing, was my immediate boss and the Attorney General. The deputy
who at the time was
John Ashcroft.
And right.
The deputy Attorney General was not read into this program. That's someone who was approved by the Senate, appointed by the president. And I felt like if I went to them, they were the ones, they knew what they were doing. So I went to the Hill and talked with a lawyer that I knew on the Judiciary Committee. And I said to her, if you tell me that Congress knows what is being done, I will just walk away. And she never got back in touch with me, so I reached out again.
And why did you say that?
Well, because, you know, I grew up in civics class thinking that we had a checks and balances system and that we had co-equal branches of government. And I thought the position that the department was taking basically was that they weren't co-equal branches. And so if I believed that the Congress one had been briefed and knew what was being done and they had approved, then, you know, I thought that that would be the end of it, at least from my perspective.
But you didn't find that out.
She told me that whistleblowers tended to get in trouble. And I said, okay. And that's when I decided to go to the press.
We should make it clear that really what you leaked to the New York Times was your belief that this was going on. You didn't leak documents. You didn't leak any names.
That's correct. Right. I didn't reveal any methods of
because
how.
Because in part you didn't know.
That's true. You know, it's actually kind of an educated guess. It's interesting. When I went to the New York Times and went through, you know, kind of a gradually grew to trust the reporter, he had sources from the CIA, presumably from the CIA and the NSA, talking about data mining. And so we kind of put it together that what the department was participating in was what they were, those other sources were talking about. So it's actually almost more the press telling me what we were doing. And I kind of opined on whether I thought it was legal or not.
You were investigated with the idea that you might be prosecuted.
That's correct. I thought I would eventually be found out. I thought that the way would be that they would subpoena the reporters and ask who their sources were. I told the reporter that he was not going to have to go to jail for me. But totally out of the blue, I came home one day and my home was filled with 18 FBI agents who were all armed, of course. Some of them were in body armor. And they had essentially searched every room in my house. And
while your wife and kids were there?
Yes. Woke up two of my children and sleeping in bed. And they took all of our computers, all of our cell phones. Actually, they missed a cell phone. My Christmas card list and other papers. And I've never gotten any of that property back. So I knew that I was clearly under investigation. And that went on for another year and a half with really nothing happening. I was still under investigation. I knew I was being followed and that my phones were probably tapped. But it was a pretty difficult time.
Eventually, though, the investigation was dropped.
Right. I mean, I had a when I came home that day, my lawyer, who had never been to my house, was standing in the street. So I had a lawyer, and we would get communications from the Department of Justice. But I got frustrated with that, so I decided again to, against my lawyer's advice, to talk to Michael Isikoff of Newsweek. And he wrote a story that basically laid out what I had done and why I had done it. And I basically was just saying to the government, you know, here's what I did. If you feel you can charge me, please charge me. And again, two more years kind of lapsed. And at the end of that time, I was told that there would be no charges. And I said, is that it? Could I get something in writing? And they said, no, we don't put that kind of thing in writing. So it just was kind of went out with a whimper.
Meantime, though, you had lost your job. You also had gone into debt.
That's right. I mean, I didn't feel like that I could stay with the department. The department, I was pretty sure, didn't want me to stay with them. And it was a real financial hit because obviously I had to hire a lawyer, and a lot of friends and people that I didn't know helped contribute to a defense fund. But I was unemployed for a while, and you know, I don't think I've ever really recovered financially. My biggest regret is what I've put my family through.
Would you do it again?
I think I was true to myself. As I said, if I could do it with a way that that my family was not traumatized and concerned about whether I was going to jail. The bottom line is, yes, I would do it again. I thought that we were breaking the law.
One of the criticisms of you has been that you were not happy with other Bush administration policies and that this was in part driven by that.
Well, I don't think that that's a fair characterization. It is interesting that 2 days after my house was raided, I got a phone call from Michael Isikoff, and he knew that my house had been searched, and he knew that I had had a disagreement with the Attorney General over whether we should seek a death penalty prosecution in a case. But, I mean, that was not what drove me at all. I mean, you could have disagreements with people that, you know, I don't think it was a political move. It was, for me, it was just, I came from law enforcement. My father was an assistant director of the FBI, as was my uncle, and they were both from Montana. And I don't think it was a political decision at all on my part. I just thought I was doing the right thing.
There are, of course, as you know, Mr. Tam, parallels between your case and Edward Snowden, who is out of the country, fears coming back because he would be possibly prosecuted for his leaks. And he leaked similar information about whether the government overstepped its boundaries in terms of domestic surveillance of metadata. What do you think of that parallel?
Well, I don't know that it is really an apt parallel. I mean, he absolutely revealed documents that were classified as secret.
Which you did not.
Which I did not. And, you know, obviously his revelations are just really broad in scope. Mine was very specific. And but you know, it's interesting because what people told me while I was caught up in this that the NSA was gathering metadata. I mean, just listening essentially or gathering, seizing almost everything. And I thought they were kind of crazy. I mean, I thought that they were like conspiracy theorists or whatever. So I do think that the fact that Mr. Snowden did what he did, I think it's troublesome to me that he felt he had to leave the country. I think he should have stayed here and fought the consequences. But I do think it's useful for us as a country now to have the discussion as to whether we want the government collecting all of this data or whether our privacy rights are being violated.
And that's my other question for you. It seems like outside of there have been a lot of stories about it, but outside of that there isn't a lot of public discussion of that there has been no great public outcry about what you revealed or what Mr. Snowden revealed.
I agree. That is absolutely disappointing. I think there's some some really fine senators, such as Senator Wyden, I think, from Oregon, and I believe Senator Udall, who have been making efforts to try and correct what's going on and what they've learned as being members of the intelligence community. And I hope that as time goes on that we will continue to debate that issue.
Do you think the reason is because people feel like the war on terrorism, that this is just a necessary component of that, and maybe, yes, you lose a little bit of your privacy, but that's for bigger?
I think that is true. I mean, I never really understood what, you know, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. I thought it was kind of a tautology, but I believe that much of what we do and what presses the ethical line is done out of fear. And I personally think that our rules and our Constitution are strong enough to fight terrorism and that we don't have to compromise our values to do that.
And what do we lose if we do that?
I just think we lose part of what we are as a country and what the founders put together. The reason that we have the Fourth Amendment is because we oppose the British troops just raiding our houses without probable cause, without warrants. And I think that still is a valid concern today.
Are you surprised the Obama administration thinks this is okay?
Yes. It's disappointing. I guess I was very naive. I actually kind of thought that with hope and change that I might be offered the opportunity to go back to the Department of Justice, and I just was incredibly naive. And he talked about transparency, and I just hope he comes back around to trying to make the government as transparent as possible.
Well, I've been speaking with Thomas Tam, and Mr. Tam is the person who did disclose the Bush administration domestic wiretapping program. And Mr. Tam, it's been really interesting to talk with you about all this, and I appreciate you taking the time. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide tonight should be mostly cloudy with a chance of rain and lows in the 30s. Tomorrow calls for mostly cloudy skies with a chance of rain and highs in the upper 40s. In central Montana, there is a high wind warning in effect until 6 a.m. tomorrow for the northern Rocky Mountain front. Tonight will be mostly cloudy with lows 35 to 40 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 45 miles per hour. Tomorrow, look for increasing clouds with a chance of rain and snow through the day with highs in the 50s. In southwest Montana tonight, watch for increasing clouds, bringing a chance of rain and snow with lows 30 to 35 degrees. Tomorrow, look for those increasing clouds to stay with still a chance of rain and snow with highs 45 to 55 degrees. And now for the editorial comments of Tom Power.
Some economic fantasies never seem to recede, even in the face of economic reality. One of these is the belief that if only more and more federal land were open to oil and gas drilling, local and state economies would enter a period of permanent prosperity. That source of extensive economic prosperity, we're told, is just beneath our feet. All we have to do is drill. But, we're told, the federal government's environmental regulations and bureaucratic incompetence block this drilling and keep us unnecessarily poor. One would think we would already be basking in the glow of that oil and gas prosperity in the Mountain West, given that employment in oil and gas development, production, and processing has increased 2.5-fold since 1990. In Utah, oil and gas jobs have increased 4-fold. In Montana and Colorado, 3-fold. In Wyoming and New Mexico, oil and gas jobs have doubled. That, however, did not make the oil and gas industry one of the leading sources of jobs in any of these states. In Montana in 2011, the oil and gas industry was directly responsible for about 1/2 of 1% of all jobs in the state. In Utah, The fourfold increase in oil and gas jobs left them at 0.3% of all Utah jobs. Over the last two decades, across all of the Mountain West, the jobs in oil and gas have averaged 0.5% of all jobs. One of the reasons for the oil and gas industry's small contribution to total employment is that the oil and gas industry is capital intensive, not labor intensive. It also makes use of a transient drilling workforce that is always moving on to the next oil or gas field. The payroll associated with oil and gas development and production represents only about 10% of the value of the oil and gas produced. As a result, oil and gas development is not a likely candidate for substantial job creation. That is not to say that there are not oil and gas booms in particular areas that can overwhelm local communities. In Montana and North Dakota, we have the boom in the Bakken oil fields, but few people hold that phenomenon as an example of how most Montanans would like to live and raise their kids. But something like that seems to be what some of the drill baby drill folks have in mind as the ideal economy for Montana and the Mountain West. A recent study sponsored by the Utah Anti-Federal Government's Sutherland Institute projects that if we could shake off the federal shackles that limit oil and gas development, that industry could add 208,000 new jobs, $27 billion in additional economic value, and $5 billion in expanded government tax revenues. In Wyoming, according to this particular economic fantasy, expanded drilling on federal lands could add 44,000 new jobs. But in 2011, the Wyoming oil and gas industry provided a total of only 9,500 jobs. Apparently, if the federal government would get out of the way of Wyoming energy developers, employment in that industry could be almost five times as great. In Utah, opening up more federal land for drilling, we're told, could add 56,000 jobs. In 2011, despite a fourfold increase in oil and gas jobs, the Utah oil and gas industry only provided 4,600 jobs. Breaking free of those federal limits, apparently, would allow a 12-fold increase in Utah oil and gas jobs. Of course, these wild economic imaginings are built around the use of large economic multipliers, treating temporary drilling jobs the same as jobs that continue indefinitely, and ignoring the basic economic principles of supply and demand. One would gather from the critics of federal oil and gas leasing policy that American oil and gas production has been strangled, leaving us more and more dependent on foreign sources. But nothing could be further from the truth. On October 4th, the U.S. Energy Information Administration estimated that the U.S. will become the world's top producer of petroleum and natural gas in 2013, surpassing Russia and Saudi Arabia. Since 2008, American oil production has increased almost 50% and natural gas by 33%. That expanded supply of natural gas has pushed natural gas prices to very low levels, leading natural gas developers to cut back on their drilling and even to close in their more costly wells, where the cost of extracting the gas is higher than the value of that gas. This is not the federal government's doing. It's tied to the fact that natural gas supply has expanded faster than natural gas demand. Blaming the reduced interest in natural gas exploration and development to the federal government is similar to the claim that the federal government has driven the production of coal downward through an ongoing federal war on coal. Coal's problems are also tied to the low price of natural gas, a fuel that competes with coal in the generation of electricity. It is also cheaper to build electric generators fueled by natural gas. In addition, they can be built more quickly, and they produce far less air and water pollution. It is economics and technology that are working against coal, not some evil federal plot. Whatever federal energy policy has done, it has not restrained energy production in the United States. In fact, there has been a perverse reversal of energy policy being pushed by natural gas, coal, and petroleum interests. In the past, we were told to worry about our heavy reliance on importing foreign oil. We talked about enhancing national energy security and energy independence. Now we're being told that we should support the export of natural gas, coal, and petroleum because it will produce more jobs. Apparently, extracting the fossil fuels we have in the United States as quickly as possible and sending them off to other nations around the world to burn is a strange new path to energy security, independence, and prosperity. Go figure.
Tom Power is one of several commentators on Montana Evening Edition. The views expressed do not necessarily represent those of the station. If you have a comment, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.